This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, good morning and welcome to The Morning Run. I'm Roshan Kanisan with Lynn Mark and Noel in the studio this morning. And before we get into all the serious business and figuring out what we have lined up for you this morning, Noel, Lynn Mark, how are you all doing this morning?
Oh, I think I'm okay. Tuesday, right? Today.
Are you already counting down to the weekend, Noel?
Yes, I am, and counting down to next week too.
You're not allowed to. It's Tuesday. You're only allowed to count down from Wednesday onwards, Noel. And Lynn?
Muddling along as usual. Excited for the show.
Such enthusiasm this morning, 6 a.m. on a Tuesday morning. Still dark out. We're waiting for the sun to rise to give us a bit of bright lights. But today on the show, on the Breakfast Grill, we've got a wholesome Breakfast Grill with Holstein Milk Company. This will be an interesting one. It's, I think, an investee company of Khazana National, but also a provider of fresh milk in the country. This will be happening at 8 a.m. and our colleague Philip C. will be tackling that interview. Hopefully, we'll get some views into how the dairy industry in this country is doing and also the financial implications of how the business is doing at the end of the day. But in this hour, we'll be tackling a few global stories, local stories, and some existential stories. Noel, what are we doing at 6:30?
Right. Existential, right?
Yes.
Such a big word for me. Anyway, nuclear talks, that comes to mind.
Definitely and existential.
Yes, that's right. And then something about COVID-19 and also Vietnam, getting some updates there.
Interesting. Very interesting. And Lynn, what are we tackling in about 10 minutes?
In about 10 minutes, we're going to be talking about the FIRE movement. So that's going to be a very interesting conversation as well. And of course, if you want to weigh in, you can WhatsApp us at 01878988899, or you can tweet us at BFM Radio.
Yeah, maybe give us some tips on how not to get burnt when playing with the FIRE movement. Towards the end of the hour, of course, we take a look at the local papers and portals, give you a view of what's happening on the ground and what's been covered by the papers. But just after this, in a few minutes, we're going to talk a little bit about how to get better at killing bad projects. What does that mean? Well, let's let the Harvard Business Review let us know in just a little bit. Keep it here to BFM 89.9.
Good morning and welcome back to The Morning Run. I'm Roshan Kanisan with Noel Lim and Lynn Mark in the studio this morning. It's now 6:08 a.m. Tuesday, the 6th of April, and we're going to talk about how to get better at killing bad projects.
I keep thinking that you're going to stop at the word killing, and I'm like, that's not what this show's about.
No, Lynn, this is not how to make a murderer. This is how to make a murderer of bad projects. So let's discuss this very, very atas article from the Harvard Business Review.
I like that.
Yeah, it is. I think I stole this from, must have been Philip C. or Wong Xiao Ning, one of the two who like to talk about these atas things, right, at the 6 a.m. hour. And I've been inspired by them to take a look at this. This is a particularly interesting one because it talks about how to get better, as I mentioned earlier, at killing the bad projects, right? But how do you define what a bad project is? And how do you go about, I guess, assessing it and saying, okay, at this juncture, this is a bad project. We need to pull the plug on this. Because, you know, the adage, I think that they start off this article with is fail fast and move forward, right? That's the mantra we've heard from a lot of tech giants. But I don't know, it's easier said than done when it comes to abandoning things that you've maybe put a lot of work into. And also for your colleagues also, right? Like if you have to pull the plug on a colleague's project who you know has toiled over this, it's not as easy as talking about it.
I think a bad project, you know it is so when you feel like it is really a hassle and it's just not you feeling that way. Maybe the other team members feel the same too. And but there's also that tendency that because some hard projects or projects that are not achieving the kind of targets that is achieving that you want to achieve within a short time frame, you know, sometimes then it's very easy to label them as bad projects, right? Because we can be quite reactionary about it. So I think the question is, I think bad projects, if people are complaining about it, it's always worth scrutinizing and before making a decision. But you know, this requires some hard conversation. And it reminds me of a situation when I was in, it was in a company trip, not this company, another company. And so during that company trip, it was supposed to be an opportunity also to discuss some projects that we were thinking of killing. And so And I remember my boss then said, okay, what about this project? And there was like a total silence. I think everyone felt like we should kill that project. But there was just a complete silence. Then somebody just made some, you know, passing remark. And then that was it. Then we moved on to this topic on what should we do with our fridge? We need to clear our fridge. And suddenly there was a lively conversation. It just tells you how difficult, you know, making a decision, you know, how difficult it can be to arrive at that. Because it's, you know, like what you say, you may step on people's shoes. Some people may be offended and so forth.
Listen, I'm one of those people that I really have no qualms about saying when I don't think a project is going to work. If, you know, feel free to prove me wrong, but at the same time, you know, when I think about bad projects, the ones that I've had experience with, again, you know, not really here, but previously as well, were projects that were based off of something that a boss believed, and the proof of concept was given to members of subordinates to essentially confirm. Right, you know, failure was not an option because this was something that to someone in a higher position than you was it just was it was a given. So your job was to make it work, and those give me a lot of emotional pain, right? Because that's, for one thing, that's bad research practice. Okay, you shouldn't be trying to just confirm a result. You should be conducting a process to see what works and what doesn't. It also means that you are very hesitant to kill the project because you don't feel that psychological safety that means that you can go forward like beyond a certain point to say that this really doesn't work, because at some point you're going to worry that your boss thinks you're a whiner or something along those lines, and that is going to impact your career trajectory. These are all concerns that I've had.
Corruption of the scientific process in a way, really, if you think
about
it.
It drives me nuts.
Because the hypothesis is not the conclusion, right? And sometimes maybe we kind of confuse this when we learn in school, because a lot of times we had thought that the hypothesis, the conclusion is just a variation of confirming your hypothesis. But in reality, not all experiments pan out.
It's an investigation,
yeah.
Right?
And yeah, I think that has to be more thorough, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Investigation,
and
testing.
And I think the acceptance that a hypothesis can fail, right? And a hypothesis that recently failed was that LG thought it could build smartphones, and no, it can't, because now it's finally saying it's throwing in the towel after 6 years and losses amounting to about $4.5 billion. And see, from the outside in, I think a lot of us could see that LG wasn't going to make it in this very, very competitive smartphone world. Yes, they came up with some cool things here and there, but they didn't have the brand that Apple does. They didn't have the scale that Huawei or Xiaomi did. They couldn't produce as cheaply as those products. And they didn't have any branding niche. But why did it take this company, this huge company that's been in the electronics games for so long, 6 years to pull the project on what was arguably a failing project from the second, third year in? Sometimes it's just, even with concrete data like mounting losses, it can be tough to pull the plug.
Yeah, I think, yeah, it's a very difficult decision. And at the same time, you want to take some risk, right? You want to try out new projects. So I think the question is, when do you pull the plug? At what points, right? So, and we shouldn't deter people from taking risk. But at this thing also about you know, killing bad projects, on wanting to kill it or not kill it, it's also due to the fact whether leaders are ready to change, right? Are they flexible enough to change, and whether the team's also flexible to go to work together. So I think it comes down to leadership as well. And sometimes you may have a very strong leader who is, you know, a risk taker and, you know, very innovative. Then the next person who comes along may be just more of a follower, and they don't take the kind of risk. That also can be not good for the company.
Yeah. So one of the things that is suggested in this article, of course, is stage gating, right? So essentially, having milestones at the 1 month, 3 month, 6 month, 12 month, 24 month stages. What milestones that does this project need to hit in order to continue living, essentially, right? Like these are your hurdle requirements. And for things that have, I guess, a legacy or a proof or something like that, it's easy to kind of, or has, there's more reliability in kind of estimating what the stage gates are, but for new projects, it can be hard. And so maybe that's why with the whole LG situation, they couldn't really stage gate because the smartphone industry is a relatively new one in this. It's about, what, 10, 15 years old at this point? Not as big, not as old as cars and things like that.
And I think when it comes to particularly product design, we have to embrace the fact that in early stage trials, you're not going to have proof of failure just yet. But at the end of the day, we have to take a step back and really objectively assess whatever it is, what product or service it is that we're working on. Because if it goes to market and it fails, then at that stage of the process, there's really no way you can avoid the losses.
Yeah, but you know what? Tell us what you think about all this and more on Twitter at BFM Radio or over WhatsApp at 018-789-8899. After this, a little bit of conversation on the fire movement and how not to get burned. Keep it here to BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, good morning and welcome back to The Morning Run. That was Alcatraz by Leon Russell. And hopefully you're not feeling like you're in Alcatraz this morning with us in the room. And I'm with Lynn Mark and Noel Lim in the studio this morning. Today we're talking about, or right now at the very least, we're talking about FIRE, not the hot one, the retirement type of FIRE, the financial independence, and whether it's all it's cracked up to be, right? Because we often hear the adage that financial independence is the be-all and end-all of life. And the FIRE movement is the pinnacle of that, the ability to retire early and live life on your own terms forever and ever and ever. But there are downsides to that, and maybe we put too much emphasis on the romanticism that comes from the financial independence aspect of it all. And maybe we don't pay enough attention to the other parts, the non-monetary parts that make retirement for most people a success.
Yeah, so the article that we're looking at this morning is from the blog of Dollars and Data, which is written by Nick Majuli. He's the chief operating officer for a wealth management company, I believe, in the US. And he writes interesting stuff about personal finance. And this particular article that he's chosen to write has spotlighted two people who found eventually that the FIRE movement was really not for them for different reasons, right? So one person whom he speaks about was forced out of early retirement due to a couple of factors. One, his partner at the time found that actually she was missing out on the experiences that their friends were having, friends who had continued working and were living increasingly fancier lives. And at the same time, this person also found that he had an unforeseen health issue that would require significant outlays in the future. So he found himself forced out of early retirement, and is actually happier now because he's refound some sense of purpose, and he's also found a new relationship because his wife filed for divorce. The other person is someone who lived kind of between 1 to 3 months in Airbnbs, you know, lives the nomadic FIRE lifestyle. And what was written by this chap, whom he calls John, not his real name, is very interesting because it's very introspective. He thinks about what time has started to mean, how you live these little mini lives in between moves. And he finds that it's actually a very lonely existence.
Yeah, so actually I think retiring early now is a bit of a myth because I think it's really quite tough unless you have a windfall gain from stock options. Like, for example, you're one of those people who worked in Hatta Lega and then the next day you become an instant millionaire, or a grand inheritance awaits, right? So because it's hard to retire now because the cost of living is going up really fast and money is becoming worth almost nothing, right? Because it earns very meager interest income sitting as a fixed income deposit. So I think it's actually quite hard to retire now. When I say retire now means really do nothing. So I think it has to be a bit of a balance. You can sort of semi-retire, but I think you still need to work. And also you have to bear in mind, the older you get, it's harder to find a job. More employers are reluctant to employ you because one, something about skills, and two, there's always that feeling that, oh, will you be able to blend into the workforce if you're older than the person who's managing you? And And there's always the impression that you may be more fixed in your ways the older you are.
And the fear that also if you've taken, if let's say you retired early and then you've taken like 5, 6, 10 years out of working life, whether or not you'll be able to keep up with developments.
Yes, you know, like even opening up Google document might be like a very strange experience, right? Yeah, so I think it's important to still have some purpose, some structure, in order to find that balance even when you decide to retire early, if you can.
Yeah, the realism of retirement is always a question that's going to be out there. But I think what this really comes down to, this particular story here, is that focusing on the sum of money you need to retire is not always going to be the be-all and all, because social structures, family structure, a home, for most people, that can be very, very powerful. For most retirees, community is what keeps them going after that. It's what keeps them entertained. It's what keeps them thinking and, you know, interacting through the day. And I think for a lot of people, so that's why John's, quote-unquote, John's article, opinion here of the fire movement basically came down to, it was for him. He was okay living the nomadic life, but he doesn't think that 99% of the people can do that, because you're moving from place to place. You've got no home base and you're constantly, things are constantly changing around you. You've got no sense of structure. That doesn't sound like what I want. You know, like that's, I want, what I want is a home base and things like that and social structure.
I reckon it's worth always testing it out, right? Maybe a month or two to test out what the kind of lifestyle that you want, and then to see if that would work for you at least for another 6 months or so.
See, what's really interesting, one particular line here is he says, you know, Vegas is fun for a week, really tiresome for a year. And I think that really encapsulates a lot of things that we think about or that we think are great, but maybe not forever.
And I think it's also important to consider really how important is your work and your career to your sense of identity, because a lot of people do identify themselves very strongly with what it is that they do. So take that away and will you feel the loss of it? My father retired recently, and as soon as he retired, you know, rather than taking a vacation, he threw himself right back into coaching, and now he's busier than he ever was. So I joke that this really isn't a retirement, but it is for him, because he enjoys, he really he doesn't know what to do with himself if he's not working.
This reminds me of a book that I read, must have been ages ago. It's called The Happiness of Pursuit. And you heard that correctly. It's not the pursuit of happiness. It's the happiness of pursuit. And that for a lot of us, the joy and the purpose of life comes from the actual journey as opposed to the end goal. And sometimes getting to the end goal kind of just ends everything there. And speaking of ends, we're going into a few messages and then the 6:30 a.m. news bulletin. To take you there, we've got Kid by The Pretenders. Keep it here to BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, good morning and welcome back to The Morning Run. I'm Roshan Karnasin with Lynn Mark and Noah Lim in the studio this morning. It's 6:40 a.m. and that was Imitation of Life by R.E.M. And right now we're taking a look at the, not the local news, the global news and what's happening around the world. And we're starting off with relations between Iran and the U.S. as they both now face difficult talks as diplomats prepare their latest efforts to end a crisis over the future of the 2015 nuclear deal. And yes, you heard that correctly, 2015. It's been 6 years and quite a roller coaster ride for this particular deal.
Certainly. Both countries are set to take part in negotiations with the EU, Russia, as well as China in Vienna on Tuesday. So that's today, later today, to map out a path to bring this deal back to life, although they will not have any direct talks between them. Tehran and Washington have notably been had some strong differences on opinion in opinion on how to revive this deal after, of course, President Donald Trump abandoned it with prejudice.
Yeah, so State Department spokesperson Ned Price said on Monday he expects the talks to be difficult and wasn't actually forecasting any breakthroughs, adding that Robert Malley, the U.S. Special Envoy for Iran, will lead the talks on behalf of the Biden administration. I think it seems like Iran just wants this assurance, right, that Washington will provide the guaranteed and verifiable removal of penalties should there be any roadblocks in their discussions.
Yeah, and on top of all of that, you're going to have the baggage of the fact that a deal was struck and then a new president came in and threw out that deal. And what's to stop a future president from doing the same thing? Because politics in the U.S. or the presidential elections in the U.S. have become very, very hotly contested.
Very polarized.
And it's been a long time since a president had a one-term presidency. I think it's was it George Bush Sr. was the last one-term president, unless I'm mistaken. And if we take a look at Biden has now recently said he's going to run for a second term. But who's to say that he'll actually win that? It could anything can happen. So he's essentially there's a minimum 4 years here. That's not great, stable news for geopolitics and to strike a deal because, again, from Iran's perspective, what's going to stop another president coming in and saying, okay, out with the old. The rules of engagement have changed and there's going to be a lack of trust with the US for a long time.
Yeah, so I think there's so much political jockeying and all these narratives that we will have to just contend with. Meanwhile, life goes on. And India, looking at the COVID-19 vaccination, I think they're ramping up vaccines as daily cases hit, I think, 100,000. I have to say that I'm quite impressed by their pace of vaccination.
Yeah, and especially since India's COVID-19 pandemic is nothing to sneeze at. 100,000 daily caseload. It was the number that they breached on Sunday for the first time since the pandemic began. So now the rule is that everyone above the age of 45 is eligible to be vaccinated. Some states are also targeting specific groups, what they call economic frontliners, like bank workers as well as lawyers. About 80 million doses have been disseminated so far, mostly to frontline workers and people above the age of 60.
Yep, 80 million doses. That's 2.5 times the population of Malaysia or thereabouts, but a fraction, a tiny fraction of the Indian population. It is the world's biggest inoculation drive and aims to cover 250 million people by July. But again, some experts are saying that the pace needs to pick up to meet that target. And again, 250 million is a quarter, maybe a third of the Indian population.
It is worth noting that India's vaccine drive has been steadily expanding. The BBC has some really good graphs to this end, starting from January 16th when the vaccination rollout began, all the way up until I think it was until the end of March, and it has ramped up significantly according to this curve. But at the same time, India is an extremely populous country, and in some parts of it, it's also extremely rural and without access to good healthcare. So it is vital that they vaccinate as much of their population as possible. We've had conversations on the Morning Brief talking about how in India as well, it's not really a choice between saving lives and livelihoods, particularly because so much of the country are members of the hardcore poor. If they lose their livelihoods, then there is a high chance that their lives are going to follow soon after.
The concerns is the rural areas. So vaccination is voluntary, I guess, like most countries. State-run clinics and hospitals are offering free vaccination, but people have a choice of going to private facilities to get vaccinated, and the government spending around $5 billion for free doses at these state-run clinics.
And very quickly, let's take a look at Vietnam, because their National Assembly on Monday elected a little-known official to be the country's next prime minister, tasked with reviving the economy in the wake of the pandemic while navigating growing US-China relations.
So this chap's name is Pham Minh Chinh. I hope I've gotten that right. He's 63, and he's risen through the ranks of Vietnam national security apparatus, and he was the only candidate put forward by the Politburo for prime minister. He served on a powerful anti-corruption steering committee, and his appointment is expected to be confirmed quite soon as well by the National Assembly.
And with that, we're going into a few messages, and when we come back, we'll take a look at the local papers and portals. Keep it here to BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, welcome back to The Morning Run. I'm Roshan Kanesan with Lin Mark and Noel Lim in the studio this morning. It's now 6:50 a.m. and that was the Doobie Brothers with Cotton Mouth to, I guess, welcome us to the soon-to-be-expected sunrise. It's still dark out, but I am eagerly awaiting for the sun to come over the hills over there. Right now, we're taking a look at the local papers and portals to give you a view of what's happening on the ground. Noel, I see you're eagerly looking at the NST and Sina Harian. What are these two papers covering on the front pages?
On NST, how to avoid a fourth wave. So interstate and inter-district travel as well as high-risk places must continue to be strictly regulated to head off a new surge in COVID-19 infections, according to our dear health minister. He says that the country recorded an R value of more than 1 from Saturday, with 9 cases of the highly contagious South African COVID-19 variant detected. So we are still not out of danger zone yet, so still please stay safe and follow the SOPs. That's basically his underlying message.
Yes, I'm looking at the Star, and the front page here is time out for jabs. So this is also to do with COVID-19 vaccinations. About the fact that employers may be compelled to give a day off to workers who have an appointment to keep with the health ministry in order to get vaccinated against COVID-19. So this is a government proposal that was announced by Khairi Jamaluddin, who's the Science, Innovation and Technology Minister. He says that he's going to be bringing the matter up with the HR Ministry at the Special Committee on the COVID Vaccine Supply Access Guarantee today to decide whether or not to make it compulsory. So that's something that I think employers will certainly be keeping a watch out for. Because I also feel that at the end of the day, it is in everyone's best interest that people get vaccinated as soon as possible. Although, of course, people will also be maybe a little bit nervous about a loss of productivity.
Yeah, and we've also got some news out of some political news out of Barisan Nasional yesterday. I'm looking at Malaysia Kini now, and their little subtitle here is "Friction in BN," and this became apparently more apparent yesterday when the BN Supreme Council meeting was abruptly cancelled as UMNO's allies decided not to attend. This was amid MCA and MIC's reservations about UMNO's plans to cut ties with Bersatu and PN, Perikatan Nasional. There was also a bit of news around a DAP lawmaker who speculated that UMNO's BN partners may join PN and BN, and would join Perikatan Nasional, and then Barisan Nasional could be deregistered. Although I did see some news around where this speculation came from, right? Because it's quite a big statement to be making. People are inquiring as to his sources at this point. And the reason why I think this was pointed out is because if UMNO was BN was deregistered, they would mean they would have to leave. UMNO would have to use their own logo or a different logo, as Pakatan Harapan had to use the PKR logo back in the GE14. So this will be an interesting one to see, because the political landscape has not settled down just yet. Every time someone makes a move, there seems to be ripple effects that kind of permeate into ways that we didn't see.
Well, good job for MACC. Sina Harian has this front page story here. They've busted a monopoly cartel who they monopolize tenders that they submit. And so 10 ministries have been identified that have been targets of these monopoly cartels. And the ministries include the Defence Ministry, Ministry of Energy, as well as Environment and Education and Health. And so these cartels, I think the tender deals are worth something like 3.8 billion ringgit. And the cartel owners own something 150 companies that have submitted tenders. Wow. So, well, anyway, good job for MACC.
Another little bit of a political commentary here. Well, not commentary so much as a comment from Dato' Sri M. Saravanan, saying that MIC will no longer show blind loyalty to any parties. It needs to remain relevant to the people. Saravanan is the party's deputy president. And there are some interesting quotes here that I would like to highlight. He said, MIC must learn from its mistake of over-listening to its grassroots in the 2018 general election. So I thought that this must have been taken out of context. But no, there's a longer quote saying that in the 2018 general election, we fielded candidates made all decisions based on the party's grassroots aspirations. In the end, we lost because the people's aspirations were different from the party's grassroots. And I don't know whether my response to that would necessarily have been to stop listening to the grassroots. I would maybe have turned the spotlight instead onto party leadership and asked whether or not you are really adequately representing the grassroots and your people on the ground. Maybe that's why you've lost support.
Or do their grassroots really represent the will of the people? I think that's also a conjecture. Mm-hmm. That's what he's kind of showing here, right? Maybe this is MIC's way of showing that, hey, we've learned, we've lost quite a bit. We need to rejuvenate ourselves and remake our image. Because if I correct me if I'm wrong here, but I think another line that I read yesterday was the fact that I think he made, he said something along the lines of basically, we've listened to Barisan Nasional and UMNO for enough, and it did well for Barisan Nasional and UMNO, but it has not done well for us. Mm. And I think the numbers are a clear enough indication of that. So that's that'll be an interesting development. Very quickly, we had some news around Dato Sri Najib Razak's appeal yesterday, and he appealed to reverse the conviction and jail sentence of the misappropriation of 42 million ringgit belonging to SRC International. They wanted to, I think, consolidate some of the, wanted to delay a little bit, but the Court of Appeal rejected the application unanimously. The Najib's counsel kicked off the proceeding by applying for a month of adjournment for the appeal because they needed more time to gather relevant documents from New York and Singapore that would be additional evidence. So the proceedings will continue, and we will continue reporting it through the station, I assume, considering the fact that this will be very big news and has its own political ramifications and implications. On that note, though, we're going into a few messages and then the 7 a.m. news bulletin. To take you there, we've got the Two Door Cinema Club, something with Something Good Can Work by Something Good Can Work. Keep it here at BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.